and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Former Calhoun County Sheriff pleads guilty to domestic assault. Saga ends with plea bargain, $65 fine. Former Calhoun County Sheriff Scott Anderson pleaded guilty Monday to assaulting his wife and interfering with the Manson police officer arresting him, changing his initial pleas to the charges after an explosive April arrest resulted in a petition for his removal and, ultimately, his resignation. Through a plea bargain reached with Calhoun County Attorney Tina Meth Farrington, Anderson will receive deferred judgment, informal probation, and a 30-day suspended jail sentence in exchange for pleading guilty to domestic assault, a simple misdemeanor, and interference with official acts, a serious misdemeanor. He must also complete a domestic abusers program and pay a $65 fine, less than the cost of many common traffic citations. Interference with official acts was a reduction from the original charge of assault on persons of a certain occupation. Heather Anderson begged Scott Anderson to stop as she cried and gasped for air, officers detailed in criminal complaints, when they came on the scene April 11th to find the then sheriff holding his wife by her neck, refusing to release her. It took six struggling officers responding to a 911 call from Heather Anderson's oldest son about 9 minutes to handcuff the belligerent sheriff before dragging him to the patrol car after he resisted arrest and refused to stand up. Scott Anderson's wife summarily denied all criminal and ongoing sexual harassment allegations in a subsequent video on Facebook, calling it a witch hunt and smear campaign in its entirety. She repeatedly asked the court in personal letters to allow them to communicate despite the no-contact order in place. Her son, Dawson Olberding, spoke out shortly after his mother's video started to gain attention, telling the Messenger in an exclusive interview that red flags of domestic abuse surfaced during his mother's relationship with Scott Anderson. Olberding described his stepfather as a recovering alcoholic who is incredibly controlling and very violent when intoxicated. Since marrying Scott Anderson, Olberding said his mother transformed from an outgoing role model into someone I don't even recognize. Following the publication of Olberding's interview with The Messenger, Heather Anderson told The Messenger that the only victimization that has taken place is what the media has done to me and my family. Following the arrest, a district court judge granted a petition filed by Meth Farrington to suspend Scott Anderson, an elected official, from office. The sheriff, 51, resigned hours before the court was scheduled to hear the evidence compiled for the petition to remove him from office, ending his 32-year career in law enforcement. Explicit details in affidavits filed by 9 officers recounted the demise of a man who had, slowly but surely, been overcome by the demons of alcoholism he struggled with for years. In emotional written testimony, they contrasted a formerly sober Scott Anderson to the man that verbally and physically assaulted the officers and deputies he spent the highest point in his career with. When looking into Scott's eyes that night, it was just like looking into darkness, said Deputy Kelly Moritz. Scott stated when he drinks, he becomes an expletive, said then-Deputy Jeff Feldhans, describing the scene of Scott Anderson's arrest. When I arrived, I met the expletive that Scott had called himself. For the first time in my life, I was both scared of and for Sheriff Anderson. They watched a grossly intoxicated man, shackled in leg cuffs to prevent him from kicking the windows out of a patrol car, verbally assaulting officers, some of whom he'd known for over 20 years, with a barrage of demeaning insults. Manson police officer Israel Swanson was headbutted in the process of the arrest, the second headbutting casualty of the evening after Scott Anderson put a hole in a wall at the home. Heather Anderson defended the move, saying her husband was attempting to get a drink of water. It was decided to place him in my patrol car because I had a cage, said Pocahontas County Deputy Weston Van Dong, calling the sheriff's conduct reprehensible. Recounting the night of the arrest as the last one with my sheriff and my friend, now acting sheriff Jeff Feldhans said he cried. In the months prior to his arrest, co-workers said Scott Anderson would act as if he was above the law. In affidavits, they articulated instances of gross speeding, reporting to work 4 days in 1 month, and then abandoning fellow deputies in need during difficult situations. In addition to resolving the charges stemming from the April arrest, plea documents also stipulated that the state would not pursue charges against Scott Anderson from the bigamy investigation of him in Pocahontas County. Scott Anderson's ex-wife, Tracy Lehman, alleged that he married his second wife in Las Vegas last October before their divorce was finalized. "He's a sheriff. He should honestly know how divorces go," she said. "He should know we are not divorced until a judge says so." In March, Meth Farrington confirmed that her office initially looked into the allegations before turning them over to the Pocahontas County attorney. She said she could not prosecute law enforcement officers in Calhoun County due to a conflict of interest. After the investigation was initiated, Meth Farrington was removed from the investigation, which was then assigned to Pocahontas County attorney Dan Fiesner. Fiesner declined to acknowledge whether an open case existed. Scott Anderson denied the allegations in a March conversation with the Messenger, accusing his ex-wife of deliberately delaying the finalization of their divorce to spite him and his new wife. The court denied a petition for relief of domestic abuse to Lehman in October 2019, about 6 months before she filed for divorce. "I've been victimized for 30 years," Lehman told the Messenger in an interview March 9th after the Calhoun County Court found Scott Anderson in contempt of court for violating terms of their divorce decree, calling the experience riddled with mind games. Following the March contempt hearing, Lehman's attorney, Alyssa O'Connor, approached Sheriff Anderson to sign the necessary paperwork to resolve the contempt of court finding and avoid 10 days in jail. In a phone interview the day after the hearing, Anderson told the Messenger that, "I would have slammed her against the wall if I had been in my uniform," during the interaction. No physical altercation ensued during the interaction. Once the guilty plea for domestic assault is finalized as a conviction, Anderson will no longer be legally permitted to possess firearms. On July 17th, Calhoun County agreed to settle a lawsuit with Tamara Swank, a former dispatcher and civil clerk for the Calhoun County Sheriff's Office, for $900,000. Swank's complaint with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission alleged years of pervasive sexual harassment, workplace hostility, and retaliation from Anderson. Welcome. Displaced Marion nursing home residents find home at VillaCare after storm ravages eastern Iowa. Sometimes it takes a disaster just a short drive away to make one realize how big the heart of their community is. That's certainly the case for residents and staff in the Fort Dodge Villa Care Center, who took in 34 residents from Crestview Acres in Marion last Tuesday after a derecho with straight-line winds as fast as a Category 3 hurricane devastated eastern Iowa. "I think it's done us a world of good as a team to have them join us for this time, because their gratitude has made us take a step back," said Lisa Eastman, Fort Dodge Villa Administrator. "It's been an eye-opening experience to understand how very blessed we are." What started as a scramble to quickly find about 80 Marion residents a new temporary placement as they were vacated from a building left unsafe by last Monday's storm quickly became a seamless organizational effort where staff put all hands on deck to get the job done. The derecho left Crestview Acres with piles of debris in its parking lot and substantial damage to roofs and two hallways, the likes of which owners Nancy and Jerry Voynia say they've never seen in 30 years of running 8 skilled nursing facilities. "Because of the damage, and because we did not feel it was safe to have residents in the damaged hallways, we made the decision to evacuate everyone for safety until we had it checked out," said Nancy Voynia. In addition to the debris that blew in from the second story of a nearby apartment complex, the building sustained roof damage and water damage. With no power, a wide variety of items that need to be fixed to get the building back up to code and widespread devastation in nearby Cedar Rapids competing for contractor attention, the Voynias aren't sure how long their Marion residents will be split between Fort Dodge, Mitchellville, and Dysart locations. After evaluating resident health and securing communications the day of the storm, which knocked out power, phone lines, and even some cell phone communication, the Voynias secured bus transportation to Fort Dodge. Those in the dementia unit were transported to homes closer to Marion. Finding manpower to unload the bus in Fort Dodge, they found, was not an issue. In addition to nearly the entire staff available, about 60 people, Fort Dodge firefighters and Webster County Sheriff's Office deputies pitched in to do some heavy lifting. Extra beds were brought in from Humboldt to accommodate the extra residents, which brought Fort Dodge Villa to a total of 106 residents, or full capacity. It was just a great scene that night. I wish more people could have gotten to see everyone in action working together, said Eastman. It was a bit overwhelming to be able to take a step back and watch it all come together. With some residents typically moved through Hoyer lifts and no such equipment on the bus, seven firefighters showed up to get everyone off board. Deputies helped settle some residents into wheelchairs during the transition. They united together, Nancy Voynia said. They really did. Demonstrating the personal connection between nursing staff and residents, the Voynias said they had no trouble getting the help they needed. They wanted to help, Nancy Voynia said. Even with added duties, not a complaint was heard as staff worked to get the job done. One staff member in Fort Dodge worked two 16-hour shifts back-to-back, making sure every resident was settled in properly, an impression that made the new residents feel seen in an hour of need and quickly turned into fodder for phone conversations with family when they had a moment to breathe. After a long trip and a substantial amount of time without power, they were tickled to death to have hot showers and hot food, Eastman said, all the while being kind, patient, and gracious about the change. The two young ladies that rode the bus to Fort Dodge really struggled leaving, she said. Please take care of our people, they said tearfully upon departure. Since then, the love hasn't grown cold. As word of the new Fort Dodge residents spread, a multitude of donations from various community members poured in, from cash and clothes for those who only brought the shirt on their back to sundries and snacks. Thanks to a seamless transition, both staff and residents came to realize through the ordeal that even when the power goes out, there's a light to be found. About face. FD schools revert start date to August 25th. Reversing an announcement released on Friday that the start of the fall semester would be delayed due to COVID-19 rates, the Fort Dodge Community School District said on Monday that the school year will start on August 25th as previously scheduled. The district sent out a message to parents and families on Monday night, informing them of the changes. We were notified today by the Department of Public Health that there were errors in the reporting data that affect our decision-making process when it comes to school, the message said. Superintendent Jesse Ulrich said when the district met with the Webster County Public Health Department on Friday, the county's 14-day COVID-19 positivity rate was near 25%, prompting the decision to delay the start of the school year. However, Ulrich said, Webster County Public Health informed the district on Monday that there were errors in the reporting data for the COVID-19, including a backlog of over 3,000 negative test results from one community medical provider that hadn't yet been added to the county's reporting data. When they did all of their calculations into the accurate numbers and the accurate 14-day average, they were estimating that our positivity rate is more in the 10% or less range rather than 25%, Ulrich said. Obviously, that is a very significant change. As of 6 p.m. on Monday, the Iowa Department of Public Health listed Webster County's 14-day positivity rate as 12.9%. But WCPH said it hoped to have more information available on Tuesday, so that number may still change. WCPH also attributed the errors in the county's COVID-19 results reporting to errors in the coding of test results from one community-based clinic that erroneously coded antigen test results as viral test results. Webster County Public Health, Iowa Department of Public Health, and the clinic in question are working to correct the errors and adjust confirmed positive case reporting to reflect the accurate data. Ulrich said the district decided to delay the start of the school year on Friday because of the high positivity rate that was reported at that time. With the new information available on Monday, Ulrich said the district could not justify delaying the start of school if the accurate positivity rate is closer to 10%. We were trying to be proactive and give you plenty of time to plan when we made our announcement on Friday, the district's message to parents said. We apologize for any inconvenience this causes. Ulrich said that the district is happy to work with families who may have had to adjust work or childcare schedules in order to accommodate the two-week delay, and noted that patience and understanding will be needed this school year. Decisions will change based on current accurate information and when that information is made available and we make decisions, he said. There will be times where we may not be able to provide a lot of notice or latitude before we have to implement those changes. With the first day of school on August 25th, the district will have its conferences and orientations for at-school learners on Thursday. Information on how to sign up for conferences and orientations will be sent out as soon as possible, the district said, no later than Wednesday morning. Ulrich noted that the district has full faith in the Webster County Department of Public Health. We know that this error was not created by them, he said. They have been fully transparent in our dealings with them. They're only as good as the data they are provided as well. We will continue to work with the WCPH to make the best decisions for our families. Webster County Public Health correcting COVID-19 numbers lowers positivity rate to 12.9%. The Webster County Public Health Department and Iowa Department of Public Health are making corrections to COVID-19 test results reporting from a community-based clinic, the department said on Monday night. Antigen test results at the clinic were erroneously coded as results from the viral test or polymerase chain reaction, the WCPH said. The department said the coding on those results is being corrected and the county's confirmed positive case reports will be adjusted to reflect the accurate data. Additionally, negative test result reporting was delayed, adding to the errors in the data. These issues, together with several large-scale testing events over the past week, have impacted the positivity for Webster County, Webster County Public Health said in a statement. According to IDPH, the percent positivity will be adjusted to reflect this correction and testing events. On Friday, Webster County's 14-day positivity rate was listed as 23.2% on the Iowa Department of Public Health website. As of 6 p.m. on Monday, that rate was reduced to 12.9%. Webster County Public Health said it hopes to have more information available on Tuesday. Evening of art, food, and fun to benefit WC Park revitalization. Legacy Learning to host East Twin fundraiser. Legacy Learning Boone River Valley will host an evening of food, art, and fun Friday night, all to raise funds for the East Twin Park revitalization project. The event will be held in the park from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., according to Maureen Siemens of Legacy Learning. We're planning on holding a watercolor workshop in the park, she said. We'll have supplies available and we'll have easels set up in a socially distanced setting. The workshop presented en plein air, a French term for outside, according to Siemens, will give participants a taste of some fundamental watercolor techniques. She and artist teacher Madeline Loring will lead the session and will be set up near the skate park. Siemens said that wearing face coverings or masks is encouraged. The evening will also feature hot dogs, chips, and a drink. Live performance art is also planned. A free will donation will be accepted for the food, entertainment, and workshop, with all proceeds to benefit the park improvements, Siemens said. This is going to happen just before the weekly outdoor movie, she said, so people can stop here for a while, then go over to watch the movie. The outdoor movies, which continue through September 4th, are held at Avila Bank Plaza beginning at dusk. This week's movie is Despicable Me. A new look. Angela's Hair and More gets upgrade to facade. Angela Davis, owner of Angela's Hair and More Beauty Supply, is used to helping others feel better about how they look. Her business involves selling wigs to those who have suffered hair loss or just want to rock a different style. But in recent months, it's her building that has taken on a new appearance. Her spouse of almost 20 years, Demetrius Gully of DG Construction, has been hard at work since the beginning of 2020 to install a new stone facade. When we purchased the building almost a year ago, we knew we wanted to change the face of it and make it a little more modern, Davis said. Make this corner look a little more appealing for Fort Dodge and help reconstruct and be a process of reconstructing downtown. And although several other buildings in the downtown are getting an upgrade to their facades, thanks to grants through Main Street Fort Dodge and the Iowa Economic Development Authority, Davis's business has not been a recipient of those funds. The location of the business, 29 North 12th Street, falls outside of the area eligible for that funding. Main Street Fort Dodge has helped me in the past with some things, but we did not receive help from them or the city on this, Davis said. This is all hard work from our end. She added, it's not as expensive as it would have been had I hired another contractor. Gully's pretty good at what he does. Remodeling this building has catapulted his business immensely. We get a lot of good feedback from the community expressing their like in the way he has reconstructed it. Davis said Gully has a talent for design. Demetrius does everything off the top of his head, Davis said. When he gets an idea, he articulates it, makes it a plan, and comes to me and says, hey, what do you think? There hasn't been anything so far that I have not liked, so I go with the flow. That's his hobby, that's his passion. We are a couple that are living our dreams, literally. Davis's business has been inside the 12th Street building for 6 years. She and Gully bought the building last year. Fade Design, a barbershop owned by Anthony Presswood, is located within the same building just south of Angela's. Fade Designs has been there over 6 years. And although Davis said the exterior of the building is beautiful now, it wasn't always that way. I think people thought I was crazy when I scouted out this building, Davis said. There was a lot of work to do. I just saw what I have today. I saw that in my mind 6 years ago. I knew it was the perfect spot. The building is also home to a 2-bedroom apartment on the east side and 2 other shops that are currently vacant. In terms of Davis's business, she sells hair extensions, hair care products for the extensions, and for natural hair care. I specialize in ethnic hair types as well as other hair types, she said. Wigs are the top seller. I sell wigs for people who just want a quick hairdo or for those who suffer hair loss, she said. Anybody who suffers hair loss, that type of deal, they come here for the comfort of a small business, getting people out of their comfort zones to try something new. Those who have recently found out that they have cancer, I think part of my job duty here is to uplift their spirits and let them know that just because they are going to lose their hair doesn't mean they can't obtain more and have fun with it and give them a higher level of confidence. Wigs sell anywhere from about $20 to hundreds of dollars depending on quality, Davis said. I have one in here now that's $335, but it's all human hair, Davis said. It's been conditioned, treated, and sewn onto a lace net to mimic natural hair. Davis was inspired by her mother, especially to see how she confronted losing her hair. I opened after my mom passed away from ovarian cancer, she said. I've always wanted to be a business owner, but with her passing, it kind of opened up a new light in terms of what I wanted to do. I saw her lose her crown. Our hair is the crown we wear, and when we lost that, it took a chunk out of her self-pride. But she rocked it like a trooper. She used scarves and different things. I wanted to be in a position to give women options. Davis also noticed from her own observations an increase in minority population in the area. One of the main reasons I opened up because I saw the minority demographic here in Fort Dodge skyrocket. It used to be a small town, and we knew everybody. I started going to the stores and not recognizing people. I thought we needed a store that had hair and makeup and things for African-American people. These people are coming from bigger cities and were looking for something they were comfortable with seeing. Davis lived in Houston from the age of 3 to 14 before she moved back to Fort Dodge permanently. Being from Houston, there was a certain way of life I was used to, she said. When I moved back, I had to travel a lot to get what I wanted or order things online. I always told myself, if I was ever able, I would open a beauty supply just because of my knowledge and my hair. I thought I could bring a lot to Fort Dodge. Davis said some of her customers are foster parents who aren't sure how to style their children's hair. Foster parents who are taking care of black kids, biracial kids, Davis said. They don't know what to do with their hair. I'm here as a vessel to give them the basics for how to maintain their hair. I learned from having my own kids. My hair is my passion. It's my hobby. It's something I do. I install extensions for people here and there. My children, family, friends, I just like hair a lot. An editorial. Remember the good cops. Most in the thin blue line just want to serve and protect. Much of the public's attention to law enforcement personnel during the past several weeks has focused on the tiny minority of them who deserve to be called bad cops. The enormous number of good officers, deputies, troopers, and agents ought to be remembered too. One of them, Toledo, Ohio, police officer Anthony Dia, wrote a letter to his family. They opened it after he was shot and killed last weekend by a drunk who later took his own life. Dia was just 26. He had been a policeman for 2 years. He left behind a wife and 2 young sons. "Tell my family I love them," were his last words. "I hope I died with bravery," Dia wrote in his letter. He did. But it is another line in his missive that bears special attention, because it sums up how the overwhelming majority of law enforcement personnel feel about what they do. "Every day I put on the uniform, it was my intention to protect the weak and innocent in my community from evil," Dia wrote. Few in what we refer to as the thin blue line use such language about what they do. Most, with the same dedication, put it in a simpler term: to serve and protect. An editorial from Mark Thiessen. Kamala Harris, a moderate? Not even close. Welcome to the leftist Trojan horse operation. In case you haven't noticed, there is a not-so-subtle campaign afoot to paint Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat from California, as a centrist, an effort that exposes the left's strategy to fool the American people into giving them political power in November. After presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden announced Harris as his running mate, the New York Times immediately declared her a pragmatic moderate. The Los Angeles Times called her a centrist, and ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos told his viewers, "Kamala Harris comes from the middle of the road, moderate wing of the Democratic Party." No, she doesn't. Harris was the most liberal compared to all senators in 2019, according to GovTrack, the nonpartisan government transparency watchdog, to the left of even her Democratic socialist colleague, Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont. Harris wasn't pragmatic either. GovTrack found she joined bipartisan bills the least often compared to Senate Democrats. According to Manhattan Institute budget expert Brian Riedel, Harris has proposed a mind-numbing $46 trillion in new spending over the next decade. She supports the economically ruinous Green New Deal, Medicare for all, and free taxpayer-funded health care for undocumented immigrants. She is also an abortion zealot who has suggested that a faithful Catholic who belongs to the Knights of Columbus is unfit to serve as a federal judge. She opposes deportation of those who illegally entered the United States and once compared immigration and customs enforcement agents to the Ku Klux Klan. If Harris really were a moderate, progressives would be up in arms over her choice. But they are not. Leftists understand that to win in November, they must be able to peel away reluctant Trump voters in key swing states who are uncomfortable with the leftward lurch of today's Democratic Party. Those voters need to believe that a Biden-Harris administration will be centrist and reasonable so they can give themselves permission to defect and vote Democrats into power. So progressives and their allies in the mainstream media have tried to portray Biden's choice of Harris as another example of how he has kept the left at arm's length. Progressives know it is a lie. Congressional Progressive Caucus co-chair Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat from Washington, recently said the left need not worry about Biden's moderate veneer because he is movable. As she told The Daily Show host Trevor Noah, "As soon as we get him in the White House, and even before with these task forces that we had, we were able to significantly push Joe Biden to do things that he hadn't signed on to do before." The left sees Biden as their Trojan horse. They want voters to look at his inoffensive, moderate, bipartisan exterior and decide it is safe to let him inside the White House gates. But as soon as they do, an army of socialists will rush out, led by Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, to impose a radical progressive agenda on America. They have every reason to believe that will happen because Biden has already given in to their demands. For more than 40 years, Biden supported the Hyde Amendment, which bars federal funding for abortions, even writing a constituent to say, "Those of us who are opposed to abortion should not be compelled to pay for them." When he reiterated his support for the Hyde Amendment last year during the presidential primaries, he was chastised by none other than Harris, who declared, "No woman's access to reproductive health care should be based on how much money she has. We must repeal the Hyde Amendment." Biden quickly surrendered to Harris and the party's pro-abortion radicals. If Biden will capitulate to his party's left wing on a fundamental moral question like abortion, what makes anyone think he won't do the same when it comes to Medicare for All or the Green New Deal? Most candidates tack to the center after securing their party's nomination, but Biden has already gone to the left, forging a unity platform with Sanders. The platform was a wink and a nod to Democratic socialists, embracing a number of their demands and promising to study others once Biden is in the White House. The left got the message. Once the election is over, Biden will move even further in their direction. Besides, progressives in Congress believe that they will be setting the agenda anyway, and Biden's job will be to auto-pen whatever they pass and put on his desk. What is he going to do? Stand with Republicans and veto their legislation? Progressives are more than comfortable spreading the myth of moderation while they hide inside the belly of the Democratic ticket, waiting for voters to open the White House gates. You're listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, August 18th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Norma Nan Brown. Norma A. Nan Brown of Fort Dodge, a devoted wife, mother, Christian, and community volunteer, passed away Saturday at the age of 89. Nan's blueprint for life was best described in a saying that hung on the wall of her kitchen for years. "The measure of love is love without measure." That is how she lived her life, raised four children, and volunteered countless hours to make Fort Dodge a better community. Putting others first was Nan's way. Rarely did you see her without a smile on her face or a zest for life. Her love was unconditional. Inside her well-worn Bible, she drew a hand and titled it, "How to Pray." Each finger was labeled from left to right. The thumb was family, the most important thing. That was followed by church, national leaders, and those who were sick. Next to the fifth finger, she wrote, "Yourself last." She was born in Aberdeen, South Dakota, on December 28, 1930, to Samuel and Mabel Bebo Nelson. An only child, her given name was Norma Arvilla Nelson. Her initials became the first name she preferred and the one everyone called her by. Nan lived in Fort Dodge for the last 68 years of her life. A 1948 graduate of Aberdeen High School, Nan came to Iowa for the first time when she enrolled at Drake University in Des Moines to pursue a broadcasting degree. In one of those classes, taught by legendary Professor Jim Duncan, she met Robert C. Bob Brown of Fort Dodge. Their first date was at Peggy's, still a Drake campus staple, in 1951. 6 months into the romance, they were engaged in the spring of 1952. Both graduated in May of that year. Nan was a member of the Kappa Alpha Theta sorority. Nan and Bob were married on June 29, 1952, at First Evangelical United Brethren Church in Fort Dodge. Bob went to work for KQTV, then KVFD Radio, before being hired as the sports editor of the Fort Dodge Messenger in 1956. Nan put her broadcasting career on hold because the radio station would not hire couples. She went to work for the Sears Roebuck Credit Department before staying home to raise a family. From 1953 to 1963, the family grew by four with the arrival of sons Rick, Randy, and Roger, and a daughter, Renee. Nan was a member of First Presbyterian Church at the time of her passing. As a member of Trinity United Methodist Church earlier in her life, she did everything from teaching Sunday school to serving lunches and writing the weekly newsletter. She also served as director for Christian education there for 23 years, retiring in 1996. She just had a way of cheering up someone's day, whether it was baking them cookies, stopping by to say hello, or dropping them a note in the mail. She loved the color blue, cats, reading books to her grandchildren, walking every day. Her vanity license plate read, "Walk, Mom." Yard work, reading The Messenger cover to cover, attending Fort Dodge Senior High School athletic events, and cheering on the Iowa Hawkeyes. Her vices were Ritz crackers, Pepsi, and chocolate stars. Nothing came before her family. With her husband working long hours and traveling from one game to another, Nan often filled the dual role of mother and father and never complained. She taught her kids the value of doing the right thing, even though it may not be the easy or popular choice, and of hanging out with the right crowd. She took great pride in the accomplishments of her family. Sometimes it brought tears of joy to her eyes. She was also a rock when life took an unexpected or tragic turn, and helped her family navigate rough waters with her faith, unsinkable spirit, and positive outlook on life. She tackled life head-on, with grace and her faith guiding her. A cancer survivor, Nan enjoyed giving back to the community she loved through volunteer work, whether it was at her church, serving as a mentor at Cooper Elementary School, or working for PICA, which she enjoyed very much. She was also active in PEO and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Nan is survived by her sons, Rick Brown and spouse Karen of Pleasant Hill, Randy Brown of Ames, and Roger Brown and spouse Jackie of Fort Dodge. Daughter, Renee Brown of Minnetonka, Minnesota. Grandchildren, Ben Brown, Blair Brown, Claire Brown, Jane Brown, Jordan Capecchi, John Dole Rader, Tia Capecchi, Sam Goldson and spouse Rachel, and Zach Goldberg, and a great-grandchild, Petra Tillison. Nan was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and her granddaughters, Meredith Brown and Natalie Brown. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, August 19th, at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. A celebration of life will take place at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, August 20th, at First Presbyterian Church in Fort Dodge. Interment will take place at North Lawn Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that memorials be left to the family. Bernice M. Andrews. Funeral Mass is 10:30 a.m. Friday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Visitation is 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. Paul Stevenson. Paul Stevenson, 89, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, August 15th at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Funeral services will be held 10 a.m. Saturday, August 22nd at Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Interment and military honors will be held in Cedar Cemetery, Rynard. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, with a vigil service at 6:45 p.m. Friday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Paul Warren Stevenson was born March 10, 1931, in Rynard. He graduated in 1948 from Lauraville High School and attended Buena Vista in Storm Lake. Paul enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, serving from 1951 to 1954. Upon returning from service, he graduated from the University of Iowa in 1956. Paul was married to Jill Horner, and to this union they were blessed with two children. The couple later divorced. Paul worked for his brother Dan, and in 1971 they partnered to establish Stevenson Insurance. Paul actively sold insurance for 55 years, retiring in 2012 from O'Connor Insurance at the age of 81. For over 60 years, Paul was very civic and community-minded. He was a 1959 charter member of the Fort Dodge Sertoma Club, and just 2 weeks prior to his death, resigned as a board member for the Beacon of Hope. Paul enjoyed the game of golf nearly daily at the Fort Dodge Country Club for years. Survivors include his children, Bill Stevenson and spouse Lisa of Manson, and Michelle Stevenson of Fort Dodge, 9 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, and 2 nephews. He was preceded in death by his special companion of over 20 years, Gail Lawson, his parents, Ethel Watson and M. Blair Stevenson, and his brother, Daniel Stevenson. Memorials may be directed towards the Beacon of Hope. Clayton D. Traeger. Graveside services are 2:30 p.m. Tuesday at Emmanuel Reformed Church Cemetery in rural Belmont. Visitation is 1 to 2:15 p.m. Tuesday at Ewing Funeral Home. Alice Bryant. Graveside service for Alice A. Lewin Bryant is 1 p.m. Saturday at the Amsterdam Cemetery in Goodall. Those planning to attend may bring a lawn chair. Face masks are encouraged. Carolyn Brown. Public visitation is 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. The family requests that face masks be worn and that guests practice social distancing. Horrifying data glitch skews key Iowa coronavirus metrics. A state agency says it is working to fix a data error on Iowa's coronavirus website that lowers the number of new confirmed cases and therefore downplays the severity of the current outbreak, just as schools are deciding whether to reopen. The glitch means the Iowa Department of Public Health has inadvertently been reporting fewer new infections and a smaller percentage of daily positive tests than is truly the case, according to Dana Jones, an Iowa City nurse practitioner who uncovered the problem. It's particularly significant because school districts are relying on state data to determine whether they will offer in-person instruction when school resumes in the coming days and weeks. Potentially thousands of coronavirus infections from recent weeks and months have instead been erroneously recorded as having happened in March, April, May, and June, Jones said Monday. It's just horrifying. We have no idea what's going on, really, said Jones. The numbers are skewed because some people tested negative earlier but recently tested positive. Iowa's system has been recording their new positive results as having happened when their original negative results were reported. It's one of the worst data errors that could be happening right now, said Megan Srinivas, an infectious disease physician in Fort Dodge. We are making these policy calls based on completely flawed numbers, and that needs to be acknowledged. She said the situation means Iowa's prevalence of infection and the pandemic's current trajectory is worse than people realize. An Iowa Department of Public Health official confirmed the glitch in an email to Jones Friday. He said a system-generated date when test results are reported to the state stays the same when an individual later tests positive. We recognize this is a problem and have been working on logic to handle it, wrote Rob Raymakers, the lead epidemiologist in the department's surveillance unit. He added, a similar situation is happening with the percent positive calculation. We have raised the issue and are actively working on fixing it. But the state has yet to publicly announce the error. Amy McCoy, a spokeswoman for the Public Health Department, told the Associated Press that she hoped to have more information about the issue soon. Iowa's overall number of more than 52,600 who have tested positive since March is not affected, a per capita rate that is 17th highest among states and the highest in the Midwest, according to Johns Hopkins University. But the current curve looks flatter than it should, and the recent rates of positive tests are lower than they should be, Jones said. School districts are relying on a 14-day positivity rate calculated by the state to determine whether they should reopen classrooms to students and teachers. Governor Kim Reynolds has ordered schools to provide at least 50% in-person instruction as long as the local positivity rate is below 15%, a threshold 3 to 5 times higher than many public health experts say is safe. So far, only a handful of districts meet that threshold. Many districts have been considering starting the year with only virtual classes because of safety concerns tied to the pandemic. But the new mandate has encouraged them to adopt hybrid plans in which students attend in-person classes part-time. Some districts have pushed back their start dates to early September and are still deciding how to proceed. Mike Baranek, the president of the Iowa State Education Association, a union representing teachers, said Monday that school districts should put their reopening decisions on hold until the data is fully corrected. Jones tracked the case counts released by the state daily and was baffled in recent weeks when cases from March, April, and other earlier dates were routinely added without explanation. She believes thousands of cases may have been wrongly dated. The number of reported coronavirus deaths in Iowa stood at 979 on Monday and could exceed 1,000 this week. The number of coronavirus patients hospitalized statewide, 283, is at its highest level since June 5th. Eli Perencevich, a top infectious disease researcher at the University of Iowa, said the state's target for reopening schools is dangerously high to begin with, and the data errors only make the situation worse. He said the state's case count was already artificially low because it excludes the results of antigen tests that some local hospitals use. Officials ID 2 killed in Missouri plane crash as Iowa couple. 2 people killed when a small plane crashed in central Missouri were a couple from Iowa, authorities said. The plane crashed Sunday afternoon near Grand Glaze Airport, killing Scott and Amy Lowe of Mount Pleasant, Iowa, according to a news release from Osage Beach, Missouri officials. The Lowes were the only people aboard the small plane, officials said. Osage Beach is about 160 miles southeast of Kansas City, Missouri, near the Lake of the Ozarks. Mount Pleasant is in the southeastern corner of Iowa, about 63 miles southwest of Davenport. Authorities have not indicated what may have caused the single-engine plane to crash. The Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board will take over the investigation. Police: man arrested at Des Moines Airport. A man was arrested this weekend at the Des Moines International Airport after a loaded handgun was found in his carry-on bag, police and federal authorities said. The incident happened Sunday, the Des Moines Register reported. 9 bullets were found in the gun, including a round in the chamber, according to the Transportation Security Administration spokeswoman Lisa Farbstein. The man was arrested by Des Moines police and faces a weapons charge, Farbstein said in a news release. It was the 3rd loaded firearm found by TSA agents in Des Moines this year, the release said. 12 loaded guns were found at the airport last year. No guns are allowed in carry-on luggage on commercial flights. Trump signs Iowa disaster declaration. President Donald Trump has signed an emergency declaration that will supply federal money to help Iowa recover from an unusual windstorm that struck a week ago. I've just approved an emergency declaration for Iowa, who had an incredible windstorm like probably they've never seen before, Trump said Monday before he left Washington for a campaign trip to Minnesota and Wisconsin. Really did a lot of damage. Trump is planning to visit Iowa on Tuesday, Governor Kim Reynolds said during a news conference, but she provided no details. Reynolds filed an expedited presidential major disaster declaration on Sunday, seeking $3.99 billion. A derecho with hurricane-force wind gusts exceeding 100 miles per hour destroyed or extensively damaged 8,200 homes and 13 million acres of corn, about a third of the state's cropland, she said. The August 10 storm killed at least 3 people in the state. More than 500,000 people lost power in the storm, and utility companies said about 65,000 people remained without electricity Monday afternoon. The federal funds Iowa requested would cover $3.78 billion in agriculture losses, $100 million for private utilities, $82 million for homes, and $45 million for public assistance. Reynolds and the federal government has come under criticism for not acting quickly or doing enough. Former Democratic Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge, who was Iowa's Homeland Security Advisor during the massive floods in 2008 that upended many of the same communities hit by the derecho, criticized Vice President Mike Pence for visiting Iowa on Thursday for a campaign stop, but not visiting damaged farms or cities. Democrats claim big tent for first convention in pandemic. The family of George Floyd, the Minnesota man whose death in police custody sparked a national awakening on racial injustice, led a moment of silence Monday night in the early moments of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. One of Floyd's brothers, Philonese, stood alongside another brother, Rodney, and praised the sweeping protests that followed their brother's death. People of all races, all ages, all genders, all backgrounds, peacefully protesting in the name of love and unity is a fitting legacy for our brother, he said. George should be alive today. The early focus on racial equity came as Joe Biden introduced the breadth of his coalition to a divided America, progressive Democrats joining conservative Republicans, and victims of police violence to deliver an urgent appeal for voters to unite against President Donald Trump, regardless of political ideology or party. The former vice president won't deliver his formal remarks until Thursday night, but he made his first appearance just half an hour into Monday's event as he moderated a panel on racial justice. In taped excerpts released before the convention opening, former First Lady Michelle Obama, wife of the nation's first black president, vouched for Biden's empathy and experience. and the extraordinary ideological range of Biden's many messengers on the opening night was demonstrated by former presidential contenders from opposing parties. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist who championed a multi-trillion-dollar universal health care plan, and Ohio's former Republican governor, John Kasich, an anti-abortion conservative who spent decades fighting to cut government spending. My friends, I say to you and to everyone who supported other candidates in this primary and to those who may have voted for Donald Trump in the last election, the future of our democracy is at stake. The future of our economy is at stake. The future of our planet is at stake, Sanders declared. Kasich said his status as a lifelong Republican holds second place to my responsibility to my country. In normal times, something like this would probably never happen, but these are not normal times, he said of his participation at the Democrats' convention. He added, "We can do better than what we've been seeing today, for sure." The unified message, outlined in excerpts of pre-recorded speeches, came as Democrats launched the first presidential nominating convention of the coronavirus era. The all-virtual affair was the first without a central meeting place or cheering throngs. And there were real questions about whether the primetime event would adequately energize the disparate factions Biden hopes to capture. Republicans face a similar challenge next week. Trump sought to undermine the Democrats' big night by hosting a political rally in Wisconsin, where Biden's party had originally planned the week's convention. He called the Democrats' event a snooze before it even began. "You know, when you hear a speech is taped, it's like there is nothing very exciting about it, right?" the Republican president said. Democrats abandoned their plans for an in-person gathering in Milwaukee because of the pandemic. The unprecedented gathering is not only testing the bonds of the diverse Biden-Kamala Harris coalition, but the practical challenges of running a presidential campaign in the midst of a pandemic. Among a series of national crises, speakers plan to address bipartisan concerns that postal service changes will make it hard for voters to be sure their mail-in ballots are received in time and counted. Ballot access is a particular concern for people of color, whose communities were disproportionately forced to wait in long lines to cast primary votes earlier in the year. At this moment, Biden sits in a stronger political position than Trump, who has struggled to expand his political coalition under the weight of his turbulent leadership and prolonged health and economic crises. But 78 days before votes are counted, history is not on the Democratic challenger's side. Just one incumbent president has been defeated in the last four decades. Polls also suggest that Biden, a 77-year-old lifelong politician, is on the wrong end of an enthusiasm gap. His supporters consistently say they're motivated more by opposition to Trump, who is 74, than excitement about Biden. Democrats hope to shift that dynamic, beginning with the convention. Biden will accept the nomination Thursday night in a mostly empty ballroom in his home state of Delaware. California Senator Harris, the first Black woman on a national ticket, speaks Wednesday. Michelle Obama, whom Gallup determined was the nation's most admired woman last year, described Biden as a profoundly decent man in a video excerpt of her remarks recorded at least 6 days earlier. "He was a terrific vice president," she said of the man who served for 8 years as her husband's number two. "He knows what it takes to rescue an economy, beat back a pandemic, and lead our country." Universities deal with outbreaks. North Carolina's flagship university canceled in-person classes for undergraduates just a week into the fall semester Monday as college campuses around the U.S. scramble to deal with coronavirus clusters linked in some cases to student housing, off-campus parties, and packed bars. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill said it will switch to remote learning on Wednesday and make arrangements for students who want to leave campus housing. "We have emphasized that if we are faced with the need to change plans, take an off-ramp, we would not hesitate to do so. But we have not taken this decision lightly," it said in a statement after reporting 130 confirmed infections among students and 5 among employees over the past week. UNC said the clusters were discovered in dorms, a fraternity house, and other student housing. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.